It's time for Microbrew, Milwaukee Brewers Chatter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, host of the show, and I got Kurt Hoge with me. He's on the other line. He's actually still in the middle of a series in Cincinnati. We never podcast in the middle of series, but this is a rare wraparound occasion, and the Brewers have taken the first three games of this series in Cincinnati, looking for the sweep on Monday night. It has been a weird week. It's a good week for the Brewers. They went 4-2, but it was weird. We're going to talk about it. There was definitely some downs in addition to some ups this week, and we're going to discuss it. After my conversation with Kurt, I have an interview with one of my colleagues at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. That is Tom Dakin, business reporter who has written a ton about the stadium financing issue, the American Family Field financing situation, how the stadium district works, and given the fact that this has sort of become a political issue. You've got guys on both sides of the aisle saying they're at least tepidly, at least interested in helping out, making sure that the obligation of the state is met and that they are able to pay for all of the upkeep and upgrades of American Family Field. But also how that looks is there's just no guarantee that there's no guarantee it's going to happen. There's a lot to unpack. So I tried to make this as easy as possible. I had a conversation with Tom, put things in layman's terms. If you're interested in that, that'll be at the tail end of this conversation. But first, Kurt. I guess we'll kind of start with Sunday. Adrian Hauser turned in a really good outing. He said he's actually been really good. If you can somehow subtract his outing from earlier in the week, his numbers have been excellent since he became a member of the starting rotation. And you combine that with Julio Teheran, a guy whose name I did not mention on the last podcast, erroneously, just a total oversight on my part. These two guys and the starting pitching in general is kind of holding it together for a team that is missing some key guys in the starting rotation. And meanwhile, guys like Freddie Peralta and Corbin Burns have been a little bit less than exemplary, less than their usual selves. So Adrian Hauser and Julio Teheran, I want to know exactly how much you think that can be sustained. How much is real? What are the signs that this is just sort of a lucky little break for these guys? What are the signs that this could continue? I mean, give me the full breakdown. Can the starting pitching actually hold it together without their main guys?
Well, they're doing a pretty good job of it right now. I mean, you look at Ray, you look at Teheran, you look at Hauser. These guys that have filled in, there hasn't really been. Hauser's outing in Toronto the results weren't great. I thought his actual pitching was better than it indicated on the final line. But like outside of that game, there really has not been a blow up start. Obviously, Teheran hasn't had one. Colin Ray's starts have all been pretty solid, except for maybe one in there. Adrian Hauser, like I said, he was, you know, outside of that game in Toronto, he was excellent again on Sunday in Cincinnati. Teheran's been solid despite not getting literally any strikeouts. Colin Ray's the only guy out of that group of three that gets like any semblance of strikeouts, which always makes you question at least a little bit how sustainable, how real it is. What Hauser's doing right now, I really do think is fairly sustainable. The command, it's going to be challenging for him to keep up as good of command as he's had in some of these starts, like the start against the Astros. It was really good. It was impeccable against the Reds on Sunday. The four-seamer has been a better pitch for him. The sinker was dominant against the Reds. So there's a lot of ingredients there that make the things that make Adrian Hauser, those ingredients have been present. So out of the three, he's the guy you pick, you know, to be able to sustain this the longest. But you know, some of the Julio Teheran stuff too makes you think that maybe you could get 8 to 10 solid starts out of the guy. We'll see kind of how the pitching rotation and injuries kind of end up lining up here, because they got some guys coming back too.
Yeah, Teheran is interesting, if only because, you know, he hadn't pitched in the big league since 2021. They sign him and he immediately has some pretty good success. And the Brewers do have a track record of taking guys and having them be successful because of a couple small recommendations, you know, a pitch that they think should be thrown more regularly or a pitch that should be thrown less. That seems to have worked for them at times in the past. So you look at Teheran and think, well, maybe that's what's happening here. Now, I also, like you alluded to this, Teheran had no strikeouts in his 4-2 win over Toronto earlier in the week. It was a good outing. You have to acknowledge that. And the Brewers defense is built right now because it is so good to work behind guys who don't necessarily have strikeout stuff. You take guys who can get ground balls like Hauser did all day. But you see no strikeouts, and that is a red flag. Like, that's something you think is not replicable. But there's so little to really know. Like, Teheran, maybe they figured something out. Maybe there is a pitch selection thing. I don't know. I mean, they need it. Like you said, though, Wade Miley ahead of schedule. He could be back soon. Eric Lauer is going to be on a rehab start. You've got Matt Bush coming back for the bullpen, hopefully. He'll be going out for a rehab start. So there's going to be some spots soaked up from the guys who are on the roster now. But I think, like, they got to keep Tehran up there and in this rotation until he proves them otherwise, right? Like, he's going to be here for at least one or two more starts, I got to think.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, they could even maybe go to a six man. Lauer's on his way back. When Miley's back, you know, these guys are on the precipice of being right back here. But certainly, if a guy's pitching that well, you know, you kind of, it's similar to the Andrew Monasterio experience right now. You just ride it out as long as you can. Also, sort of the Owen Miller experience, but like he's kind of been doing it long enough now where you're like, are you just riding a hot streak or is he kind of just a pretty good hitter?
Yeah, we will absolutely talk about Andrew Monasterio. That was a crazy week for him. And exactly, I want to get to the heart of that. Like, at what point do you say it's real and have to start making decisions with that in mind? There's a big one. I'm going to talk about that in just a minute. But I do feel like still the story of the week, you know, like I said, it was an interesting week. They went 4-2. They almost gave away a couple of those games that turned into wins. One went to extras. It was extremely frustrating against the Reds, but they did pull it out. Then they nearly lose a 9-run lead before surviving for a 10-8 win on Saturday, Sunday, much, much calmer in Cincinnati. But the injuries, I think they've crossed the threshold now from, you know, previously, I think you could say, well, every team has injuries. I don't think teams have injuries the way the Brewers have injuries right now. And outside of Brandon Woodruff, I still think you could make the argument, probably Willy Adames too, but there was a chance this was always going to be a shorter-term issue. Outside of Brandon Woodruff, they're not missing studs. They're survivable. But at some point, I mean, you just lose every shred of depth you have. The rotation, of course, decimated with the guys that I mentioned who are out, and Aaron Ashby, who of course has been out all year. You know, Luis Arias should be back soon, which is encouraging, but he's been out all year. Obviously the long-term stuff with Mitchell, and then Darren Ruff and Tyrone Taylor going on the injured list on the same day. Ruff with a kind of a freak thing, running into a tarp and tearing up his knee, which brought up Jonathan Singleton. Good story that we'll get to, but the injuries have crossed the threshold for me, Kurt. I think previous to this week, I think you could just say that's life, that's baseball. Now we're getting into this is getting ridiculous. So I guess you just hope this good news that with Miley potentially coming back, Arias coming back, it actually stays that way, because at some point they're going with an entire like triple A starting lineup because of the number of guys who are out. I mean, I guess you gotta say that the news seems to point to in a direction though where the tide might be able to turn right about now, right?
Yeah, probably. But then again, their hottest hitter had to leave the game Sunday because he got hit in the face.
Incredible.
Punched in the face by a base runner. Like, it's just unbelievable at this point. How do the three injuries that have happened in the last 10 days, how do any one of them happen, much less three of them?
Yeah.
I think there is conversation to be had about tarps. I never thought I'd be saying this. But Darren Ruff, the reason his knee was lacerated so badly was because there's a metal cylinder under all that tarp. You kind of think of running into the tarp as a soft thing, but it's not directly exposed metal, sure, but it's, you know, it's covered by that big advertised cover, that sponsored cover. But at the end of the day, like, you've got a player running full speed, and you know what he runs into is essentially like kind of sharp metal. And I'd never thought about that until now. Like, what are we doing there?
Yeah, that just wild stuff. And Ruff, you know, laceration sounds scary. It'll probably be okay. But Ruff is one of the guys that they brought in and had been hitting the ball very well. The numbers weren't there, but still, and we've talked about that, seemed to be hitting the ball just about as well as anybody. And now he goes on the shelf. Tyrone Taylor's injury sounds maybe probably the most concerning of what we've seen this week, because he has had problems with that elbow before, getting scratched from the lineup. I think the way he's hit this year, it's clear that he's either fallen off a cliff or he's still really, really bothered by that injury. And I think you got to be a little concerned with the outfielders that they have coming back and the outfielders they have in the system, that Taylor might not have a spot much longer, but the injury issue is a significant one. And so that's not great news for him and for the Brewers. Yeah. If Miley indeed is ahead of schedule and Willy Adames indeed comes back and Arias comes back, I think we go back across that threshold where it's just sort of injuries that every Major League Baseball team runs into. So I'm willing to think that they're on their way through the woods, but they sure have to battle. And you get guys like Andrew Monasterio, which is a crazy story. I'm going to be honest with you, Kurt. I'm going to tell on myself a little bit. When I follow the Brewers minor league system, I tend to follow the prospects and kind of like see how the prospects are doing. I did not go to spring training. I didn't really follow spring training. When they called up Andrew Monasterio, I had not heard that name before. That name I'm sure I've looked at it and seen it in box scores, but it did not register to me as a name of somebody who would play for the Milwaukee Brewers at any point. And I went back and looked, and not only is this his second year in the organization, his numbers are not that bad, particularly when you cut out his really young years, like age 17, 18, 19, when he was, you know, he's from Venezuela, new to the States, struggled out of the gate. He's possibly a pretty decent player. And my Lord, did he show it this week? He got his first career base hits on his birthday to start the week. He had his three-run homer for his first career home run on Sunday. He's flashed some incredible defense. He made a great play in extras to, I think, kind of save a game against the Reds. I mean, how real is this guy? Because the move we're talking about is Bryce Turang has struggled a lot. And if Monasterio can hold his own at shortstop, there is a window where they maybe send Turang back to AAA to kind of work on what he needs to work on offensively. Obviously, it depends on Monasterio being healthy after Sunday's game. It sounds like he's probably okay, but they might have something here, right?
They might. The at-bats have just been so good, and the contact has been so loud that, you know, paired with a little bit of some higher level track record hitting the ball in the minor leagues, like there's certainly a chance that like you have a solid utility infielder here. Now we'll see when it's more than a 20 plate appearance sample, but that ball he hit out, you know, in Cincinnati today, it's a small park, but that's the one spot where it's kind of difficult to hit one out, you know, like just left of center there. So he played a ton in spring training, and it's like kudos to the, you know, the Brewers, I guess, in their player acquisition, like their scouting, you know, whatever it took to sign him initially as a minor league guy last year, and then, you know, want to re-up and keep him in the organization this year. You think you saw something there. So it's certainly unexpected, but, you know, then again, looking at the numbers here, 933 OPS at AA last year. Granted, that was as a 25-year-old, and then as a 26-year-old this year in Nashville, 810 OPS. Like, he's hit. He has a hit tool there. He has maybe some sneaky pop as well. Assuming this, you know, this punch to the face from Will Benson isn't that big of a deal, I don't see how he goes down to AAA again at this rate with the, you know, even with Adames and Urias coming back. I think he sticks, and you kind of ride this out as long as you can. And, you know, maybe the Brewers have a little bit of an under the radar gem.
Yeah, and if that's true, if when those guys come back, then I do think it's Turang. I don't know how else it could be anything else. I think Bryce Turang ends up going back to AAA, which I really didn't see a pathway for that to happen before the arrival of Monasterio.
Mm-hmm. Turang and Toro.
Oh, well, Toro too. Yeah, Abraham Toro, who had a home run.
Got two spots this week, probably.
Yeah. Okay, well, yes. I mean, that's the logical one. So that could be potentially pretty interesting. Again, I don't know how real it is with Monasterio. I do feel like, you know, there isn't the expectation that this is going to maintain, but he's a guy who's gotten better in the upper levels of the minors. And it's possible that, you know, even as an older guy at these minor league stops, he's really the real deal to some degree. And he got absolutely robbed too on Thursday by Kevin Kiermaier with one of the best defensive plays in baseball this week. Just, you know, would have been another extra base hit, Kiermaier making a ridiculous play. So another great story this week. John Singleton comes up to the big league team that mentioned the Darren Ruff injury that brought up that opened up a door for Singleton, who has also fared pretty well at AAA this year. He's a guy who has not been in Major League Baseball since 2015. Kind of I'd say a pretty well-known story, a prospect who is coming up and got a multi-year deal from the Astros even before he'd become an established big leaguer. And it actually worked out for the player more so than the team. He really struggled. He had some drug suspensions. He's pretty open about all of this and really had to go through a lot of non-traditional routes to work his way back to the big leagues. And now here he is. You've been in Cincinnati. You got to talk to him. He seems like a pretty chill guy. So there wasn't like a ton of like explosive emotion, but it sounds like all his teammates are really excited for him. I know you talked to some guys who played with him at AAA too. It seems like a really cool story.
Yeah, not explosive emotion, but you can just tell how much it means to him to get back to this point. And the thing that keeps getting brought up is, man, this guy really has to like baseball to take the path that he took from being an uber prospect to failing at the big league level, the suspensions, being completely removed from the game, playing in Mexico in 21, grinding it back out in the minor leagues last year, grinding it back out in the minor leagues this year. After, remember, he was on the 40-man for about a month in the offseason. He thought he was right back in the mix for the big league roster. And he got DFA'd, grinded back out in the minor leagues. So it's you know, more than anything, it's a fantastic story. Anytime a story like this pops up, it's awesome. I think it's even a little cooler kind of because you remember that first time around for him. Everyone was kind of aware of how big of a prospect he was and kind of aware of his story and what happened. Then all of a sudden, you know, he pops back up. And I guess that's, you know, saying it like that sort of undersells the grind that he had to go through. You know, he just pops back up on our radars, but just the crazy amount of work that he had to do behind the scenes to get back here, it's remarkable.
He's an interesting flashpoint in Major League Baseball history, too, because he was kind of right at that front end. I mean, he was in that prospect-heavy group that was coming up with Houston that ultimately led that team to a World Series. Singleton obviously wasn't a part of that, but he, you know, took that big contract, and that was kind of one of the first contracts that a young player took that people were kind of grumbling about because it felt very team friendly at the time. And it was rewarding a guy who, you know, hadn't been to the big leagues, but also probably underselling what his long-term projected value is. And I think most of the time those contracts work out for the team. The player becomes great. And then he's basically a bargain for the remainder of the contract. Singleton is that one example that really stands out of a player who ultimately did not pan out and was able to secure his future, even though it didn't ultimately work out for him. And so that's kind of an interesting counterpoint to I'd say, what most people think of when they think of that situation. And like you said, he's got to love baseball. The guy had $10 million over the course of 5 years. He didn't have to do this. He didn't have to, you know, grind and grind and grind in all those different places to come back. And I do think he's hit well enough, Kurt, at AAA where I think he could be effective. I think his spot on the roster is contingent on, you know, Darren Ruff's health. I mean, I imagine when Ruff's back, it's kind of a no-brainer. The team released Luke Voit this week on the same day Darren Ruff got hurt. So first baseman, it's not like they have a ton of other options, but I mean, they do have a couple. So I don't know how long he'll be here, but I think he could hit a couple bombs, right? Like, I'd love to see a John Singleton bomb.
Well, the Darren Ruff injury is like, it's pretty severe.
Oh, you think? It is bad. Okay.
I mean, he's walking around in crutches. Like, it's a deep cut. It's not your normal just cut.
Dang.
Like, I don't know. I don't know how long it's going to take till he's able to, like, move as needed and everything heals up that needs to be healed. That plus the fact that the Brewers seem to like having kind of that extra DH type, that big bat on the roster. In the past, it's typically been a right-hander to kind of buoy Rowdy Tellez, and we've seen that work absolutely zero times, those guys being able to hit lefties. But Singleton does have that in his advantage, that this is kind of a roster spot the Brewers generally just give to a big guy who's a theoretical bopper, emphasis, given their past history on theoretical here. But his profile is like, there's reasons to think that he could work, you know, a little bit at the big league level. Like, he walks a good amount. We saw some of the raw power when he hit a ball 700 feet foul on Friday. That would have been cool, by the way, if that ball had gone fair. He ended up singling on like the next pitch, but would have been a homer in his first game back. So
what a tank.
Yeah, I mean, if he produces, like, he'll be around for a good chunk of time. There's at bats for him right now. He's on the strong side of a platoon, although it's not really a platoon right now. If he's just going to be mostly a DH, that job's kind of his. So yeah, we'll see how long it ends up lasting. But if he hits, it could last a while.
I didn't even mention Jesse Winker. Last time we had the pod, Jesse Winker was not yet on the injured list. He'd left the game with some neck soreness. He then did go on the injured list early in the year. He has struggled mightily this season as a left-handed bat. I'm not sure when he's coming back. You know, obviously it's about the neck issue first and foremost, but with his struggles, I imagine they're going to want to get him a ton of rehab work in the minors to try to get right. And absent that, I don't know when we see him again. I think it's at least theoretically possible we don't see him again. I think that's unlikely, but it just was not working out with Jesse Winker, and it might be injury related. And if so, they gotta work hard to they got a long time where they can gotta try to get that right. Let's go to the pitching. Corbin Burnes. Every time I bring him up, I always say, oh, he's fine. He's not dominant. He's fine. He's not dominant. You know, you posted about his outing against the Reds, where the Brewers did end up winning that game. That was the Friday night game that went to extras. Burnes allowed 3 runs. Not terrible. 3 runs in 6 innings. He did get ejected, but he probably would have been checking out of that game anyway. He's been fine, but that's all you could say he's been for the last year, the last calendar year. You pointed out his ERA is 3.67, and you did a really good deep dive on jsonline.com to try to isolate why Corbin Burnes has gone from truly one of the elite pitchers in baseball to, I would say, slightly above average, and just slightly above average. And it wasn't easy. I mean, there are a lot of things that you kind of rule out, a lot of things that you try to point to and interrogate, and it's kind of hard to pinpoint. I think ultimately you arrive at the possibility that it's just a sequencing issue. Maybe too many cutters are to blame, that the rest of the league has caught up a little bit to the cutter, but I don't know. Can you kind of explain kind of what you were looking at, and maybe if you were able to come with any conclusions?
The conclusions were mostly, I would say, on what it's not. Like, the stuff has not taken a significant step back, which is probably the most encouraging sign for Burnes and the Brewers. Like, he's still nasty. His command has been, you know, pretty solid too. Initially I went in thinking like, oh, he's just not living on the edge like he used to. He's still pretty much living on the edge. It's just he's getting hit harder when he's not on the edge. I think there's maybe been a little bit of bad luck to it as well. But, like, the home run numbers have gone up. The whiff numbers are way down. The walks are a little higher. Although that's generally a little easier to figure out, the walks, as opposed to the homers and the strikeouts and whatnot. So it creates for an interesting quandary, really. Like, okay, the stuff's there. How healthy is he? Are his mechanics fine? Like, he's thrown a lot, you know, he hasn't been injured at all. So you're not really sure there. Are guys just seeing the cutter more? I came away from it not really knowing what the answer was to what's kind of been keeping Corbin Burnes from being elite. But all the numbers show that he has not been that version of himself now for basically the last 27 starts, which is kind of an arbitrary number going back to the All-Star break last year. But it seems like there's kind of a clear mark there of where it started to fall off a little bit.
I think if you wanted to distill away all the problems plaguing the Brewers, I think you ultimately could come back to Corbin Burnes and Freddie Peralta haven't been themselves. Peralta had an interesting start. He allowed 3 runs in the first inning against Toronto. He did not allow any other runs the next 5. And two of the runs he allowed were on a screamer home run that hugged the opposite field, right field line. So, like, it was a really good swing. It was not a great pitch, but, like, you know, sometimes that happens. Peralta and Burnes not being dominant is a big issue, especially with Brandon Woodruff out. Now, if they get Woodruff back, like around the All-Star break, and Burnes and Peralta flip a switch, I do think this Brewers team is as dangerous as any team out there. I do think now this team could be a World Series contender. You know, if you have those three pitchers pitching their best, they're still a World Series contender. I don't care what the offense is. The offense is good enough at that point. But we haven't had that. We have not seen that this year. And I think that might be, if you're really worried about one thing, it's Burnes and Peralta have to be better. They have to flip a switch. They have to figure it out and be consistent. And if they are better, then Brewers are a team that can do some damage. Absent that, I don't know what you have here. You have a slightly above average team in a division that's poor, so maybe they still go to the playoffs, but it's really hard to envision them as a World Series contender without having that one thing. And I mean, yes, obviously, ideal if, like, offense sprouts up from different parts of the lineup that we haven't seen so far too. I don't know. Am I going too far by suggesting that, or do you think it is quite, you know, that is essential?
I don't think it's too far, especially in terms of the playoffs. Like, this team's path is the same that it was in 21. It's the same that it would have been last year. Like, get in and you just, like, your offense is not going to be good enough probably to put up 9 runs against good playoff pitching. So you will need your aces to pitch like aces. So that's still the plan. So yeah, absolutely. For them to go really far, they need those guys to pitch really well. And they probably in general just need Peralta and Burns to pitch better. But it's still this overarching theme of like, JR, this division is not good.
No, so bad.
The Brewers are 32-27. And the Pirates are hanging with them. They're a half game back. But now there's some real distance. Like, it felt like everything was crowded up like 5 days ago. Now there's some distance in there. The Reds are 6 back. The Cubs are 6 back, but winning as of now, recording this. Cardinals are 7.5 back. Like, they have not made that big. They've made their, you know, a small push. They haven't made their big push yet. And it's June 4th. It still feels like it's going to come because it's the Cardinals at some point. But like, the Brewers' path to the playoffs is pretty clear. It's just like, play decent ball. And they do not need Corbin Burns to have a 2.0 ERA to play decent ball.
Yeah, I guess that's true. While we're talking about the division, let's talk about the Pirates a little bit. We have poo-pooed them. We have said, well, they're off to a hot start. And then they fell off and they lost like 11 in a row or something. And it's like, yeah, okay. We're good. We know where this is going. Well, now they've bounced back. They sweep the Cardinals this weekend. And some dramatic stuff. I mean, the vibes, as we've talked about before, crazy good in Pittsburgh. Andrew McCutchen has bounced back and is having a really nice year. Jack Sawinski hit a couple balls into the San Francisco Bay this week. You know, they're getting some gutsy performances from guys that you probably haven't heard of. And I past Memorial Day, you know, we say you kind of know what you have with your baseball team. Well, the Pirates haven't gone away. They're still, like you said, a half game back, and the Cardinals have fallen off a little bit. I will never stop thinking about the St. Louis Cardinals if I'm thinking about the National League Central. I just cannot. It's going to take a lot for me to think of them as buried. They just have too many weapons. I know their pitching is what it is, which is me, but too many weapons. But at some point, I guess you have to say, okay, the Pirates are a thing. The Pirates are a problem. And this series coming up in June might actually be a pretty exciting series. I know you look at these numbers sometimes, like we've played a game of, is it real or not? Pretty much through this whole podcast, Pittsburgh Pirates, is it real or not?
It's real enough to, I think, maybe crack 500.
All right.
Yeah, that's where I'll go. It's past Memorial Day, so I got to give it some credence. They've got a lot of talent there. They really do. It'll be interesting to see. It just feels like a lot of guys are still maybe outperforming the true talent level, or, you know, the peripherals a little bit. But you know, they've stayed afloat just long enough. Now, the flip side of that again is like the Brewers messed around for, you know, they've kind of been messing around for a month and a half now before this Red Series. And the Pirates could not take advantage of that despite starting off what was it? 20 something and something.
Yeah.
20 and 8, 20 and 6, something crazy like that. They are not in first place right now. So the Brewers, I still believe the Brewers are the better team. They're the more talented team. But I've seen crazier things happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I'm still not worried about the Pittsburgh Pirates. I think if you're a Brewers fan, you see the Pirates sweep the Cardinals, and even with the standings being what they are, you think, good, that's what you want right now. Because if the Cardinals fall off and start selling at the deadline, for example, that's what you want as a Brewers fan. You don't want St. Louis thinking they're in this thing. I don't think that's what ends up happening. I think St. Louis will absolutely be in this thing through and through. A couple more things before we get to 3 up, 3 down. The bullpen is a puzzle to me. Is it great or is it terrible? I alternate. obviously they are neither. They're I think north of the median, which is good, a good place to be. Devin Williams continues to shove. No notes there. He's awesome. Even though he did walk in a run, he had to get out of quite a jam on Saturday afternoon. But the Saturday game was weird because you had a couple guys give up just a ton of runs and make a 9-run lead into a very tense finish. Jake Cousins, who was sent back down to AAA as of Sunday. Trevor McGill, who was unable to locate anything. They don't have a lot of names back there. They've gotten some really good performances. Elvis Peguero had an amazing extra inning to keep the Reds scoreless with a runner at second to open things up in extras on Friday. He's kind of stepped up. I think Bryce Wilson has officially gotten into dude status. I mean, he is clearly one of their best bullpen arms at this point and has turned into quite the find for the Brewers. So a lot of positives, also just a lot of head-scratching negatives. So I shouldn't say a lot of head-scratching negatives, a couple, and that the deep back end of the bullpen, back end meaning the guys that that you use in lopsided games, haven't really been there yet, but I don't know if that's a big concern either. I mean, they did still win Saturday after all, so I guess it worked out, made sense. What is your take on the bullpen, just in general? I know it's hard to pin that down as a unit, but what would you say about them at this point?
Yeah, this bullpen is just gonna outperform some of the peripherals because they don't have a ton of guys that strike a ton of guys out. But the big thing you have going for you, as simple as this sounds, JR, is you have a guy at the back end who is Devin Williams, and he is very good. And if he is pitching in games, you are almost certainly going to win that game. And a lot of teams do, like, that's, I mean, that's a half of the equation, maybe a third of the equation in terms of winning close games. So that's huge. They've been able to deploy him in a lot of different roles. And I don't want to understate. I feel like we've talked about Devin a lot on this podcast, but I don't want to understate how important he is and has been. Yoel Piams has maybe been just as big, even bigger, just kind of the various situations and pickles he's gotten out of. So having those two guys be able to miss some bats as well as get weak contact, get grounders has been big. And you're not very far away from getting some reinforcements in the bullpen either. Although the track record has not been great the last couple of trade deadlines. I don't know if you know that.
I'm aware.
About some of the reliever trades. Okay. Yeah. You've been alive and you have eyes. So
it has been an utter disaster. They traded for Drew Pomeranz in 2019. That was gold. Every single trade for a reliever has been an utter disaster, but I, off the top of my head, can only think of
they've only
utter
been
disasters.
Bad. They have only been bad. I don't think the Matt Bush one was necessarily a disaster because they still have him and like he could be fine, and Antoine Kelly's not really anything. But Reese Olson, by the way, made a great debut for the Tigers. He was sent away in the Daniel Norris trade, which probably a lot of people, including some members of this podcast, labeled as a question mark at the time that happened. So if the trade deadline goes better than that for the relief group this year, they could end up having a pretty nice bullpen, by the end of it, even if only one of the guys really has any sort of track record of success.
John Curtis, Trevor Rosenthal, Matt Bush, Taylor Rogers. I will say the David Phelps deal in 2020 was good. They got three prospects that aren't like important, but David Phelps ended up really struggling with Philadelphia, and Philadelphia is one of the teams the Brewers snuck past on the last weekend of the season to get a playoff spot. So I guess that's okay. That's a 3D chess move. Yeah, it's been rough. The reliever deadline deals. I feel like, Kurt, though, those are kind of a little bit like playing the lottery. I mean, you could just as easily for 2 months get a guy who like has a 0.0 ERA, you know. It's sort of a, I don't know how much science. I know there's a little science, of course there is, but they could just as easily get two guys who changed the course of history this year at the deadline. So
for as much deadline trade knocking that, you know, we've done and will do the offseason reliever acquisitions have been pretty good. Elvis Peguero was kind of he was not the headliner of the Renfro trade. Piams was seemed like a throw-in in the Contreras trade. Bryce Wilson was cast to the side by the Pirates, and now the Brewers are using him to, but you know, potentially beat the Pirates in the division race. There's just guys up and down the bullpen that are kind of like that, and so they've done a pretty good job all in all, but those trades have been bad.
Kobe Milner and Peter Strzelecki are two other guys that were, you know, just brought in non-traditional ways. I think we'll talk. We could maybe talk about Joey Weimer feeling it at three up, three down. End of the Luke Voit era. We could touch on that a little bit. The Brewers did release him this week. He had gotten hurt. He was also struggling mightily. Went to AAA, and they ultimately decided to move on. I don't think that's going to burn them, Kurt. I think it's sort of a weird little mini soap opera, the whole thing with him, whether or not he was going to sign out of spring training or not. And he ultimately signed. For a while there, he was kind of a guy everybody was obsessing about because he had a really good spring training. I don't know if it's necessarily the cautionary tale that speaks to the Brewers' sort of love of guys with reverse splits. It seems like they like to add those guys, but then they play them in a more true platoon situation, and it doesn't work out. I think Luke Voit is a pretty good example of that. We're talking about a really small sample with him, so hard to draw some sweeping conclusions. But what do you think about that? Is that strategy kind of causing you to scratch your head a little bit?
I don't know if the platoon guy getting reverse platoon splits guys is necessarily strategy as much as it's kind of just how it's played out. Keston Hira, just that's how he sort of ended up. Luke Voit was acquired. I mean, his role ended up being against lefties, but he was acquired to sort of be, you know, a potential big bat with a good track record if they could get him right. Spoiler alert, he was not right. It is a bit baffling that just the amount of reverse platoon splits guys that they have. But then they got Darren Ruff though, who's the exact opposite of that. So it's just a weird sort of thing that the offense has been built around, honestly played a reason in the fact that they've struggled so badly against lefties.
Yeah, Brian Anderson's another guy who fits that mold. Rowdy Tellez at points in his career has kind of been that way. We haven't necessarily seen that lately either. So, okay, let's go into some of the more granular details from the week. I know we've talked about a lot, but let's find some interesting little nuggets from the week that was. It's 3 up, 3 down. Kurt, I'm going to start with what happened on Sunday, not in Milwaukee, but in Appleton, Wisconsin. I should say not in Cincinnati, but Appleton, Wisconsin. Willy Adames already back, seeing some at-bats. He was in the Wisconsin Timber Rattlers lineup. He got a double on his first swing. So that's pretty cool, given the fact that just a little over a week ago, he was smoked by a line drive off his face in the dugout. Very good signs. It sounds like all signs have been just amazingly positive in terms of he's not, I don't even know if he really was ever showing concussion symptoms. I mean, he went on the concussion IL, which made sense, you know, just by virtue of getting smoked in the head, but it doesn't sound like he ever really had symptoms other than just pain, you know, obvious pain. So, the fact that he is close to returning this quickly, I think is amazing. It sounds like possibly Tuesday he could be back with the team. I haven't said that yet. I'm sure there's still a few more hurdles to clear, but if it's not this week, I guess at this point I'd be a little surprised. So great situation. And you could talk more about that if there are any more, you know, any more inkling details that you have on his situation.
Honestly, no, nothing particularly more to add there. So I'll just pick it up from there.
All right.
How about Blake Perkins, JR?
Yes, amazing.
Hitting a grand slam.
Incredible. First career home run for him.
Yeah, that's twice this year that a player's first career home run for the Brewers has been a grand slam. Bryce Turang did it on the home opener. So, Perkins comes up Saturday when the Brewers find out Tyrone Taylor is going to have to go on the IL. He's in the lineup that day. He hits an RBI single for his first career RBI and then socks a grand slam that ended up being completely needed, even though it gave them a 9-1 lead at the time, as they almost blow the game, a 10-8 game, where Devin Williams had to walk the tightrope at the end. It needed all four runs. Well, I guess maybe at least needed at least three of those runs to come away with the win. It was a pretty cool moment for a guy who, you know, kind of looked overmatched his first time up and did not look overmatched by Graham Ashcraft, who they obliterated.
Yeah, Graham Ashcraft had a very, very bad day. That was definitely the tonic the Brewers offense needed, even though it did get exciting at the end. I will go to Corbin Burns' outing. He has made a few plays, a few catches on the infield. It's always eventful when they happen. He likes to run back to the dugout full sprint to kind of show off his athleticism. It's kind of just a weird game, and it's fun. But he was really unhappy with the home plate umpiring in his outing on Friday night. He made a sliding catch, impressive catch to end the sixth. He spiked the baseball in frustration, subsequently got ejected from the game. Now, he was at 100 pitches. No way he's coming back for the seventh unless I'm completely wrong about how this team operates. But kind of an interesting moment. Burns showing his frustration a little bit. And you know, the strike zone was, I thought that night, it was interesting, but it was also, I didn't think necessarily one-sided toward the Brewers. I could be wrong. I don't know if I was maybe following it as closely as others, but Corbin Burns, it's always exciting when he catches a fly ball. Something interesting is going to happen, and that certainly was the case Friday night.
Yeah, I thought he was just messing with Rowdy at first.
Yeah.
They like to give each other some grief in the field. No, he was not doing that. Yeah, no. He was up to something else. All right, I'll keep it rolling. The guy we have not talked about coming back from, I guess, from injury too much, as a possible bolster to this team, JR, would be Eric Lauer's return. We talked a little bit about his schedule there. But what if they get him back as the healthy version of Eric Lauer? I bring this up because we talked to him today, and it's for much of the year, confidence and just frustration with what not being sure what's wrong has really bothered him, and you can tell. But today he was a much more confident version of himself, you know, feeling like he was throwing harder in his bullpens and whatnot. So he's making a rehab start Tuesday with the Sounds. We'll see where it goes from there, if they have to have him make another one or if he just comes up right away. But a healthy Eric Lauer, where, you know, he's getting that zoom on the zoom ball, yep. Big deal.
For my third, there's no question where I'm going to go with that, and that is on Wednesday, Rowdy Tellez hit a triple in Toronto in his old haunts, I guess is the term there. Hit a triple. It was glorious. It was eluded a fielder into the corner, and my guy Rowdy standing on third base. Now the Brewers ended up losing that game, but it's just one of the great moments in baseball when a guy as big as Rowdy is rolling around the bases to the tune of a three bagger. His third career triple, first of the year, of course, but third career, which sort of blew my mind. It's right up there with Prince Fielder having two career inside the park home runs. I always love it when the big guys get moving. Rowdy getting three bases, that was for me. And gotta tell you, wasn't feeling too bad about that loss on Wednesday after, or I think it was Thursday. I think I'm mixing my days up, but this is the day game on Thursday. Wasn't feeling too bad about it because Rowdy got that late in the game and kind of made everything okay, if you ask me.
Inspirational. Truly, truly, truly inspirational.
Oh, I love it.
I'll wrap us up with some Joey Weimer talk. He's been talked about a lot on this here pod. It was a great week for him. The results were solid. He hit a homer, had a couple doubles. But even more so than that, between the walks and hitting the crap out of the ball just about every time he put a swing on it, it was kind of the first real glimpse, I think, that we got to see of like, oh, yeah, that's Joey Weimer. Like, that's the best case of Joey Weimer right there. He's had a little bit of stretches here and there, but he put it together over the last six games. And I think that's kind of a big deal. Like, it's not a huge sample, but it's enough to say, all right, he's maybe figuring things out.
Yeah, the defense, we've talked about this before, the defense has made him invaluable. Like, he's not going anywhere because he's such a valuable part of their defense as a quality center fielder and a flashy center fielder most of the time. And then you throw in that offense, you could see the effort, which isn't always a good thing. You could see how hard he's battling up there. But then he's hit a couple bombs, and I don't mean home runs. I mean bombs, home runs, and smoking the baseball and looking just more and more and more comfortable. And that is obviously what the Brewers want to see. I don't know if we've seen that out of Terang on the other side of that coin. You know, he is struggling offensively. A lot of at-bats that he looks a little uncompetitive, and defensively, he's made some great plays and been solid, and obviously when Willy Adames is out, it's nice to have that shortstop, but I don't know if the defense has been so otherworldly lately that it would justify keeping him in the lineup with this bat, which is why I think Monasterio, having the success he has, might lead into Bryce Terang checking in at least again with AAA. They'd probably have to use an option that they have not already used since he made the opening day roster. I don't know if that matters to them at this point. Probably not, but that is, I think, kind of what the Brewers, you know, I'm speculating, but that's probably, I think, what the route they would have to at least explore. A couple things we did not talk about in 3 Up, 3 Down. Mentioned it earlier, but Monasterio's first two career hits coming on his birthday. I tried to figure out when that last happened in baseball. I couldn't come up with the answer. I do know Adalberto Mondesi at the time with Kansas City had his first two career hits on his birthday back in 2016. So that's the closest to that particular milestone. Abraham Toro homering in his first at bat. You know, Jesse Winker was part of the same trade, has not homered yet this year, and then they bring up Abraham Toro, and immediately in his first at bat, he hits a home run. I don't think Toro is going to be here all that much longer with guys coming back, but I found that very funny. And then Elvis Poguero's escape on Wednesday. I think I mentioned that already and thought that was a pretty cool moment. How about a Wednesday night game where the Brewers had no strikeouts and no walks? That was a start by Julio Teheran. Brewers win that game 4-2 over Toronto. Got a little dicey at the end. Devin Williams with a spear save, catching the final out of the game on a ball back up the middle. Really an impressive way to end the game. But the no strikeouts, no walks thing, I believe, has not happened since 1992 for a Brewers team. Wasn't sure if that was in any game or just in a victory, but you got to go way back to find a very statistical oddity sort of thing. I thought that was kind of fun as well. All right, let's go back in time a little bit. It's Remember When. Kurt, I'm going to riff on Blake Perkins, our guy hitting his first career home run as a grand slam. That is the second time this year a Brewers player has hit his first career home run and had it be with the bases loaded. Of course, Bryce Turang did that on the home opener against the Mets, making for a very exciting 10-0 win. I'm going to go back to 2011, Kurt, which is the last time before Bryce Turang that a Brewers player hit his first career home run and had it be a grand slam. Do you have any idea which player I'm going to be talking about?
I should, because this note has been tweeted out, but I do not know what's up.
He is a pitcher.
Oh, Sean Markham.
Sean Markham.
Oh, yeah, I thought we weren't talking about him anymore.
So let's talk about Sean Markham anyway, because I'm a big Sean Markham defender. I feel like he gets a bad rap in Brewers history, and I wanted to talk about this little moment and then talk a little bit more about his season. But yes, on the 4th of July, with a big crowd on hand, of course, it was a Monday at Miller Park at the time, sellout crowd day game, and Sean Markham hit a grand slam, his first and only career home run. That put the Brewers up 6-1. It was on an 0-2 pitch against Daniel Hudson in the 4th. I don't know how that happened, but he did not get cheated. It was a clear cut into the Brewers bullpen. It was not gentle. It was a well struck ball. And then the Brewers had this big lead, but you know, in a week where we could talk about leads almost disappearing, Brewers blew that lead 6-1. It was not great. I believe the Arizona Diamondbacks scored at least once in each of the final six innings, including two in the ninth against John Axford to break a tie. It won the game 8-6. And I think the Brewers all struck out. Weeks, Morgan, and Hart all struck out in the final inning. So it was a real rough one. Coming off the fact that they had just lost a 6-run lead the day before against the Minnesota Twins. And it was another 6-1 lead. So they had 6-1 leads in back-to-back days and blew them both. This was in Minnesota on Sunday afternoon. So they were smarting. They were not playing well. This was obviously in the middle of the 2011 season. And it was tough. This, by the way, was the first grand slam of the Brewers season. It snapped the longest drought in Major League Baseball. The Brewers had not hit one since middle of 2010, June 14th, 2010. So that was well over a year. So that was the longest drought in baseball at the time. Markham had 5 RBIs in the game because he also had an RBI fielder's choice in the third inning. That actually was the first run of the game. But you know, it didn't end well, but it was kind of fun. Only other pitcher in franchise history to hit a grand slam was not a Milwaukee Brewer, but a Seattle Pilot, Fred Talbot, in 1969. Because pitchers can't hit anymore, I assume they will be the only two pitchers to hit grand slams in Brewers history. Sean Markham was not a good hitter. He batted 103 with one RBI, or was hitting that when he hit the grand slam. He was, though, the third pitcher to homer that season, along with Giovanni Gallardo and Zach Greinke. So three of their best pitchers, their three best starters, all homered that year. I think that was kind of funny. Brewers team hadn't done that since 1970, their inaugural season in Milwaukee. Of course, the Brewers rematched with the Diamondbacks that 2011 season. It works out in the end. They get the best of Arizona. But Sean Markham is, as you mentioned, sort of a polarizing figure in Brewers history. He is known for what he did in the playoffs, where he was a little dinged up, or a lot dinged up. He did not fare well against Arizona in the NLDS. He did not fare well in Game 6 against St. Louis in the NLCS. He famously gave up 4 runs in the first and then was pulled from the game with I believe, you know, the injury that he was facing. So definitely set the Brewers behind and they lose that series. But, you know, Markham... Gallardo's probably the guy that you say is the best pitcher on the 2011 team, but Markham went 200 innings. He had a 3.54 ERA, 1.156 whip. That was the best on the staff. He had 158 strikeouts to 57 walks. According to WAR, Baseball Reference WAR, he was the best pitcher on the team by a lot. He had 2.9, Randy Wolf at 2.5, Axford 2.3, Gallardo 2.3, Greinke, Zach Greinke way down there at 1.4. I think we kind of came to terms with the idea that he got a lot of good fortune, Zach Greinke did that year, even though he was undefeated, famously undefeated at home at Miller Park. I think Sean Markham was a good get. They traded Brett Lowry for him, a top prospect. I think they got a lot out of it. It did not end well, so it doesn't get remembered well. But I think Sean Markham was a good guy. All right, Kurt, I will let you refute that because I know Sean Markham brings some pain to Brewers fans. So,
oh man, can we fold Kurt Blanch into this?
You want to? Let's go.
I was going
to
go a different direction, but I.
All right, let's do it.
I may have just done laps around my hotel room here in Cincinnati.
All right, it's Kurt's take of the week. It's Kurt Blanch.
Ryan Braun sends it to left center and deep. Get out of here. Gone for Ryan Braun. He just hit a walk-off
home. I am not well right now. Well, first off, I want to address one thing you said about Zach Greinke having good fortune. That man had a 2.9 FIP that year. He struck out a league best 10.5 per nine innings while only walking 2.4 per nine innings. I'd venture to guess he actually got bad luck. His BABIP was probably pretty high or something.
We should strike that from the record.
I'm Zach Greinke respecting here.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. I love
Zach. Sean Markham disrespecting.
Okay.
Sean Markham in the regular season, everything that you said about him was true. It was a good trade. He was, I really don't know who the Brewers' best pitcher was. Greinke, I think, was phenomenal. Gallardo was probably the front of the rotation ace. I mean, he started game one for a reason. Sean Markham was reliable, a bulldog. But just and it's not entirely his fault, but the misuse of him in the playoffs, It puts a damper on the whole thing. I don't think you can talk about his career as a Brewer in a positive light because of it. He was pitching, so it largely is on him, but the usage is not on him. And it's not just the playoff performances that went awry. No, not just awry. They went completely awry. They went, could not have gone worse, JR.
But
I'm not getting to that yet. His September was bad. There were signs of this. He had a good start to begin the month against the terrible Astros. 7 shutout innings, 1 hit, 1 walk, 8 strikeouts. And after that, it started to go south. Over his last 4 starts of the year, he gave up 18 earned runs in 24 innings, an ERA, which should have told you everything you need to know at the time, of 6.66.
Oh no!
Should have just called it quits there.
And then they were playing the Cardinals. Devil magic.
Yeah, did that happen? No, it did not happen. He got lit up in his first start, which, you know, of course he's going to start game 3. That's his spot in the rotation. Okay, he got lit up. That's just one bad outing. Okay, you know, you're up 1-0 in the NLCS. You got to have Sean Markham pitch. It's his turn. Got lit up again. Considering the fact that he was injured at this point, and that's all kind of come out over the years. Like, he was pitching hurt. He was bad in September. He was even worse in his first 2 playoff starts. He was facing a lineup that torched him to the moon in game 2. In a must-win game 6, what are you doing pitching him? And because of that, it puts a damper on the entire Brewers tenure. And, he's the Eric Bledsoe of Milwaukee Brewers.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with any of that. He was bad in September, and which actually make his numbers, I think, a little more impressive for the season. But he was clearly not himself. And I think one of my pet theories in 2008, to go back a few years, is, you know, if you don't start Jeff Suppan in game 4 of the NLDS, you have to do something creative. They didn't have a lot of other options. But if we had been in a place at Cross Major League Baseball where teams were willing to, say, have a bullpen game in the playoffs or just have an opener or do something a little bit different, have a guy that you think is going to go 3 innings like the Brewers did in 2018, to fast forward, I think the Brewers have a much better chance of winning that game. I think they put the wrong guy out there. and ended up falling behind the Phillies and never regained.
Yeah, they put the wrong guy out there against the Cardinals in Game 6, and then they put the wrong guy out there after that. Chris Narvison was the next guy out. Like, just
yeah, you are absolutely right. I agree with that.
What's going on there? I don't get it. Sorry.
Cardinals with the ultimate troll, going 4-1-4 in the first three innings. Four runs, one run, four runs. David Freese had a little bit to do with it.
Child Kurt was not pleased at that particular point in time.
No. I do agree they needed to probably go a different direction. And they didn't. Ron Renicki's tenure was probably could have lasted a little longer if maybe they had thought something different. What was your take of the week going to be? I feel like I interfered here and short-circuited what could have been an incredible take.
It wasn't as passionate as that one was. I might save it for later. I'll keep it stashed away.
All right. So Kurt and I holding a little bit of a referendum on Sean Markham, and we'll see where maybe you have opinions. Where do you fall on that? You can feel free to message either one of us on Twitter. I'm at J.R. Radcliffe. He's at Kurt Hogue, CYRTHOGG. Kurt, do you have any more thoughts before I send you away?
Still Taylor Swift ticket less.
Get your boy to a Taylor Swift show. It had to pain you to see all of your friends in Chicago at Soldier Field over the weekend posting their videos and their photos. And man, Kurt, I respect the Hive. I don't get it. I would never want to pay that much money to see any one artist, let alone sit in the upper deck of Soldier Field to see that one artist. It seems madness to me, but I respect those who love that. And I know there's millions of you out there. So, someday, Kurt, someday you're going to get to see Taylor Swift. I can sense it.
It's madness to me, too, but a different kind of madness.
All right, now I move to my interview with Tom Dakin. Again, he is a colleague of mine at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He is a business reporter, has written a ton, which you can find all of this at jsonline.com, written a ton about the Milwaukee Brewers stadium financing situation. The stadium district right now is considered the landlord of American Family Field. This is not a unique setup to Milwaukee, but the landlord is in charge of paying to just kind of keep the place up. And there's a clause that indicates that if X number of stadiums have a certain feature that the stadium district is obligated to finance those projects. And that's how it's worked. The problem is the stadium doesn't really have the money anymore. The stadium district, I should say, doesn't really have the money anymore to keep up with what the projected upgrades are going to be. So the question becomes, well, how are they going to finance that? The state is involved. People on all sides of government are involved. It's a touchy issue. There are taxpayers who obviously don't want to pay more for American Family Field. There was a tax collected in the five county area for 20 years, which helped finance the construction and the upkeep of American Family Field that sunset a couple years ago. There are a lot of people that don't obviously want to pay more. So this has become quite the debate, but it's still a little bit complicated. And there's actually a little bit controversy this week around somebody who's involved with the stadium board and has been for well over a decade, 15 years, in fact, who just left, presumably after a vote over a new scoreboard. So that is something that Tom and I talk about here. We don't have all the details on that yet. We've written about that, but Tom does a great job of explaining this. He's really, really good at sort of breaking this down and making this as easy to understand as possible. It's complicated for me even, for sure. So I really enjoyed chatting with Tom. Here is that conversation. We will chat with you again next week. Bye, everybody.
My guest is Tom Dakin, business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He has written a lot about the stadium financing situation in Milwaukee. Last week, Rob Manfred was in town, spoke to reporters at American Family Fields, used the word obligation about 15 times in a sentence to underscore what is going on. And we didn't talk about it on last week's podcast because with the holiday and everything, I wanted to sort of circle the wagons and bring Tom back in here to chat a little bit about this process, particularly for people who only follow, you know, the sports side of Brewers baseball and don't really have a handle on the, I guess, the economic side or the financing side. So just, I want to take a bigger picture to start with, Tom. The money, I think that there are people who believe that what legislators in Wisconsin are voting on is new money that's going to go to the Milwaukee Brewers. And that's true in some respects, but it's also money, to go back to Rob Manfred's word of obligation, that has been promised to them through the stadium district setup. The stadium district does not have the money to fund what the Brewers say they need, excess of $440 million, to continue keeping Miller Park, or might as well just get that one out of the way, American Family Field at a high level. So I guess, you know, there is a, sort of a legal component to this, I guess. So can you kind of give that broad strokes explanation again, that this is basically the government trying to fulfill a contract that has already been made by the government? Is that correct, or is that oversimplifying?
That's correct. And that's why I keep trying to boil this issue down to those basic facts. In 1995, the state created the stadium district. It's called the Southeast Wisconsin Professional Baseball Park District, to own what was then Miller Park, now American Family Field, and lease it to the Brewers. That lease ends at the end of 2030. That lease requires the stadium district, the publicly funded stadium district, to pay for all major capital improvements. Excuse me, most major capital improvements. There are some improvements that the Brewers are required to make that are considered quote-unquote discretionary. So, for example, when the Brewers added the golf simulators.
X-Golf, right.
Right.
Or the barrel yard upgrades.
Right, the barrel yard upgrades. That was all on the Brewers' dime. But most of the major work that happens at American Family Field is the obligation of that agency. And that's what's at issue. When the stadium sales tax was ended by the requirement of the legislature and Governor Tony Evers 3 years ago, there was set aside around $70 million to pay for those ongoing obligations, at least through the end of that lease, through the end of 2030. The Brewers at the time kept quiet on that, but they were telling the stadium district officials behind the scenes, look, we don't think the assessment you did is detailed enough. We need a deeper dive. They have since done that deeper dive. That was vetted by the State Department administration through a consultant that it hired. And that came out with a very long, detailed list of work to be done over the next 20 years. So going beyond the 2030 expiration date, mm-hmm. but assuming the Brewers would stay beyond that. And that's where we get that more than $400 million figure that we've been talking about. What Governor Evers proposed doing was spending $290 million, combining that with that $70 million set aside, and then the interest earned on those things to pay for that money over the course of 20 years. The Brewers, in return, would extend their lease to 2043. So that's where we're at. And right now, this is all being discussed between members of the legislature controlled by the Republicans and the Evers administration. Evers, of course, is a Democrat. And what I'm hearing is that in addition to some of the Republican legislative leaders like Speaker Robin Voss wanting the city and county to help pay for this, and as you can imagine, the city and county are essentially saying, we're broke.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a desire by legislators on both sides of the aisle to have the Brewers lease extend even further, not ending in 2043, but perhaps going some years beyond that.
It seems to me, when you think about the sunset of this county sales tax, that we were headed here at some point, you know, that they were, mm-hmm. I can't imagine they thought, excuse me, I can't imagine they thought the $70 million or whatever, $78 million, whatever it was going to ultimately, you know, hold this over for X number of years for the duration of this lease. So what would the alternatives have been? I mean, was this always a path we were headed down? Was it a miscalculation? I mean, how do you sort of describe the big gap that we have between the money that was set aside and the money they're going to need?
Well, you could have kept the tax. You could have kept the tax, which right. was 0.1 cent for the five counties in southeastern Wisconsin. There was no political will to do so by either Republican or Democratic legislators. So that's why the tax came to an end. When people ask me about this, and I try and break it down in as simple terms as possible, I talk about the lease, and I also say, not to try and sound like I'm dumbing it down, but sports facilities are really expensive to build, yes. and they're really expensive to maintain. So if you're going to commit to building a stadium for a professional baseball team, an arena for a professional basketball team, such as we did with Fiserv Forum, be prepared to pay for it beyond what you spend to build it if you want it to be kept in good condition and keep the team in your town. If you don't care, if you're fine with the Brewers leaving at the end of 2030, I certainly respect that position. That is a perfectly valid point of view, including for some of our elected officials to say it's not worth it to spend the money. I think the follow-up question, though, for any person, including journalists, is say, okay, if the Brewers do indeed leave at the end of 2030, because there is no stadium funding beyond that point, the lease has come to an end, they can then go to wherever they want to go, what do you propose to do with American Family Field?
Mm-hmm.
You still have a building over there. It doesn't go away. It still costs money to maintain, even when nobody is playing baseball games there. And again, maybe there's a response. Well, we'll tear it down at God knows how much cost, tens of millions of dollars, and we'll make the land available for private development, or we'll convert it into some other use. Kind of hard to converting baseball stadiums into other uses other than baseball stadiums, but you could try. Again, the bottom line is, I think as both voters and journalists and public officials, when we go into these decisions, we need to be aware of the long-term ramifications. And I'm not really sure there was that great awareness back in 1995 when this was being debated of, great, we'll build the stadium, they'll stick around for X number of years, but hey, at some point we're going to have to re-up and spend a lot of money keeping it in ship shape if we want to keep them for our children or grandchildren. And I don't think we tend as human beings to think in those long terms. Certainly elected officials are kind of notorious for only thinking about the next election and what helps them keep their job. And as journalists, actually, we need to do a better job of thinking about those things as well and explaining to our readers and to the public why these things are happening.
Which brings me now to Rob Manfred coming to Milwaukee. And I wouldn't say what he did was threatening, putting the idea in people's heads that the Brewers could leave at the end of 2030. I think that's implied just by his very presence, but I don't know if that's exactly what he said necessarily, but it's there. But you bring up points. There's really twofold reasons why I just feel it's a little bit hollow. One is that legislators, like you said, are concerned about staying in power. And the one thing you can do to really make yourself unpopular is to be the reason why a pro sports team left town.
Sure.
So there's almost always bipartisan support for really anything supporting pro sports teams. And you can call that gross if you want. I mean, if you're not a sports fan, I think that is gross. And if you're a sports fan, it's comforting. Like, these people don't want to be the bad guy here. The other front is, and this was articulated to me by some economists when I was talking about this a couple months ago. Major League Baseball wants to be in business in Milwaukee.
Right.
They have a fan base that draws at least charitable, middle of the pack, despite playing in the smallest market in Major League Baseball.
Yes.
Most charitably, they're a top 10 attendance draw. Maybe not right now, but they have been. And so that's not, especially as this league looks to expand to go through expansion, which is more lucrative for the other teams and the owners who are already in business.
Right.
There aren't many markets available that are going to outperform what Milwaukee is already doing. In fact, I would say there are no markets that you can safely say will outperform. They have this asset of a domed stadium, the only domed stadium in the Midwest in Major League Baseball that hosts a Major League Baseball team. And they've used that a couple times over the years. That's not a huge reason why you would stay in business because you have that stadium, but yeah, like, I don't know what happens to it if for some reason the Brewers are gone. All of this is to say, I don't feel like there's any way the Brewers leave after 2030. I don't feel like there's a path to that actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm being naive, though, I've thrown that out, but I don't know. How would you respond to that? Do you feel like that possibility really does exist?
Those are all great points. But if I were an elected official, again, a state legislator or mm-hmm. a governor having to make a decision on this, the rhetorical question I'd ask myself, the question that Clint Eastwood as Dirty Harry asked, do you feel lucky, punk?
Yeah.
I mean, that's really what it comes down to, is how much leverage do you think you have in your negotiation versus how much leverage does the other side have,
mm-hmm.
the Brewers? And let's go back to the mid-90s. There was a brief push to get the Selig family, Bud Selig at the time was the owner, later the commissioner of baseball, to put the stadium in downtown Milwaukee.
Yes.
The idea being, okay, if state taxpayers are going to help you out, bud, then you should do something to increase the economic impact of a new stadium by having it in a downtown area where you will have more impact on hotels, restaurants, other ancillary services. And Selig basically said, no, our fans don't want to go there.
Mm-hmm.
They want to stay out where we're at, which they basically ended up doing. I think the real reason was also the Brewers would have lost a lot of parking revenue had they gone downtown, because people would have parked all over the place, different lots, structures, what have you. Probably someone would have taken even the bus, mass transit. Imagine that. Imagine that in Milwaukee, using the bus to go somewhere other than Summerfest and State Fair.
Can't tailgate on the bus, though, would be the pushback.
But there would have been, they would have accommodated tailgating, obviously. But my point being is that the mayor at the time, John Norquist, who was pushing for that, and other elected officials, in the end, folded. They weren't willing to look Bud in the eye and say, this is a red line. If you want the money, you have to do this. And what ended up happening, of course, is legislation was passed. We got a county sales, a 5-county sales tax, and it was built basically next to where the old stadium was.
Yeah. I think the leverage comes in if Governor Tony Evers, I don't know which term he would be on in 2030, if they walk, no matter how much good he's done for the state, he will be the guy who let the Brewers walk out the door, walk to another state.
Sure.
And I feel like that's true for a lot of legislators. But like you mentioned, local legislators in Milwaukee are like, we don't have the money for this. So
right.
At some point, and that felt like a very proactive move. I don't think anybody at this point is saying, other than maybe Robin Voss, the assembly speaker, suggesting that Milwaukee County foot more of the bill. But they're proactively saying, look, you're going to come asking us eventually. We cannot do that. I'm guessing there's nothing the state can do now, right? I mean, I don't even know how that all comes together.
Well, that's all wrapped up in the whole local funding package that our colleagues like Allison Deer and Molly Beck have been covering, where there seems to be a general consensus among both Democratic and Republican legislators that local communities, including Milwaukee, need more shared state revenue. Milwaukee is a huge economic engine for the state of Wisconsin. It provides way more state revenue than it gets back, thus funding helping fund communities all over the state, including many represented by Republican legislators. I think they understand that. In addition, there's this effort to allow the county of Milwaukee to increase its local sales tax and allow the city to have local sales tax. But all of that is still being negotiated, and that takes precedence over stadium funding. I am positive we will not see a stadium funding proposal until the local funding proposal comes forward, or maybe they come forward in tandem. But that local funding proposal is really what's using up a lot of energy right now on the part of both state and local officials.
Got it.
So hopefully that gets resolved and we see something this month. It's now June. And then we see something on the stadium and then that will be available for the public to weigh in and say whether they like it or hate it and tell their elected officials thusly.
Yeah. Okay. So one question that I asked you actually, I texted you because I was really confused about this at some point. All of the proposals coming from the state government have come with the attachment that then the Brewers would extend their lease through like 2043, I think was one of the years.
Yes.
Basically 20 years, adding 13 years to what the lease is now. And the more I thought about it, the more I didn't understand why the Brewers would do that, why there would be leverage to ask them. Because, again, this is part of an arrangement, how to pay for a contract that's already in place. So in theory, the Brewers are already owed this money, even though, you know, we don't even know what all the expenses are. But they're owed it based on the terms of the stadium contract. Why would they say, oh, yeah, well, we'll do that for you. We'll help you out and we'll extend our lease. Well, if they're owed this, what? Why would the Brewers want that? And I thought you had a really interesting answer that I hadn't considered before.
Well, the Brewers want to stay here for the long term. That's part of it. I mean, I think they are sincere in saying that for the reasons you were talking about earlier. And the Brewers also see an opportunity here. Because right now that money that the stadium district is obligated to provide is only through the end of 2030. That's only another 7 years.
Yeah,
and that
right.
7 years is going to come faster than we think, folks. Trust me. And so here's an opportunity for them to get extended more than a decade beyond that. And the Brewers' grand plan, part of this $400 million plus that would be spent, a lot of it is just basic stuff that needs to be done. Again, stadium, big stadiums that are under heavy, intense use by the public need a lot of work to maintain them. You've got a moving ballpark roof that in and of itself is a huge expense that needs constant maintenance and upkeep. A new scoreboard, a new this, a new that, a lot of HVAC stuff, elevators, escalators. But also the Brewers are looking down the road at wanting to attract a younger generation of fans, many of whom, unlike you and I, JR, don't go to the ballpark to watch the game. They go to the ballpark to socialize. And if you look at what other ballparks have been doing lately, and I wrote a story about this a few months ago, look at the Cleveland Guardians Park, look at some of the new parks down in Texas. They're very much geared towards those types of public or group facilities where you could walk into them and there's a great game going on and nobody's watching it. They're drinking their cocktails. They're drinking their beer. They're having a great time. And they might turn around occasionally when they hear the crowd roar for a home run, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Brewers want more of that. And again, that can be construed as a public obligation because going back to our earlier discussion about the keeping up with the Joneses clauses, every other major league ballpark now has this. We need it too. Pay up. And much easier to get that done over the long term than trying to cram it in the next 7 years. And if you, and you know, they, this is a mechanism to achieve that.
Sure.
To achieve that end.
Rob Manfred, when he was here, referred to the stadium as a gem. And I think Brewers fans, for the most part, are pretty happy with the stadium. And I think even the Brewers brass would say this stadium, the upkeep has been good.
Yes.
The stadium district concept is not unique to Milwaukee. They have one in Arizona, the Maricopa County district. But that stadium, it has not worked out. And I don't know the inner particulars of why that arrangement hasn't been good. But that stadium is just a couple years older than American Family Field. It's kind of falling apart.
Well, the Diamondbacks actually sued.
Yes,
under
the clause.
You did not fulfill your lease obligations. We're going to take you to court, and I believe they won a settlement out of that. So, yeah.
So, I guess, you know, I look at American Family Field, and I think, you know, does it need all of that? Does it need all these? Is there anyone out there saying that this stadium is substandard? And of course, most of this is proactive, forward-looking. The whole idea is to keep it at this level, and I totally get that. It's very unsexy when you're talking about HVAC stuff. My blood is really pumping for escalators and elevators.
Yeah, yeah.
But that is a challenge in the presentation of this as well. But is anyone saying that the stadium is below standard, or this is just purely like this is, as you say, keeping up with the Joneses?
It is just that. And yeah, and I don't think anyone's arguing that American Family Field is in bad shape. But again, things can turn quickly when you don't spend the money on a big building. And I would ask people, just think of an analogy of if you're a homeowner in terms of your own home. Did you repair the roof? Maybe you put off a little while, but are you going to wait until water is leaking into your living room? Probably not.
I would personally. I'm very, very lazy.
I suspect Mrs. Radcliffe would have something to say about
that
decision.
She would leave me, yes.
Yes.
Yes, that is. I do not have the leverage in that in that exchange. Before we go, I want you to explain a little bit of this story. By the time people are hearing this, it will have published at jsonline.com a little about some kind of intergovernment turmoil that kind of came from this. So can you kind of explain what's happening?
Yes, yes. We're discussing this on June 1st. The story is being published today at JS Online. This regards a member of the Stadium District Board, a man by the name of Mark McCune. A week earlier on May 25th, same day the commissioner came to town, coincidentally, the Stadium District Board's Operations Committee and Finance Committee met and voted to fund a new scoreboard that the Brewers want. The old one was installed in 2011. It's coming to the end of its life. Again, the Brewers came in and said, hey, look, it's currently among the smallest scoreboards in the league. We have to get it back up into that 25%. You know, we want you, the Stadium District, to spend $6.5 million and give it to us by next year, by 2024. And the district approved that. What was interesting was the district had a 3-hour closed session. I was the only reporter there. You're welcome. And then they went into public session, and it was very quickly done. Very little discussion. And they also, for lack of support among the board, did not go forward on another proposal by the Brewers to spend about $2 million on a secondary scoreboard. And I think this, again, has to do with what is considered discretionary and what is not considered discretionary and who should pay for it. Mr. McCune was the only member of those two committees to vote against both items. It was a 5-1 vote. Unfortunately, he had attended that meeting remotely, so I couldn't talk to him then. Tried to reach him on Friday, no dice. And then I found out a few days later that he had actually resigned from the board on that same day. I can't help but think that those two events are related. Mr. McCune is a veteran board member. He's been there for 15 years. He was vice president of the board. He represents Washington County, but is a bank executive. So somebody who obviously knows something about lending money. I'd be really curious to hear his thoughts. If he hears this, I hope he gets in touch with me. But of course, you know, he's not obligated to do that. So we'll see. But yeah, the story is basically about that resignation and how it's coming at perhaps an inopportune time for the district and for the Brewers.
Man, we are just scratching the surface. The passions that get inflamed when this stuff gets going. And oh, wow, it's going to be fascinating. I can't impress upon you enough to read Tom Dakin in the Journal Sentinel,
jsonline.com.
Always read Tom Dakin.
Always.
He's got he covers a lot of business matters, a lot of building matters, and this is a big building for sports fans.
It sure is.
The American Family Field thing just getting started. And Tom, I really appreciate you joining me. We'll chat again very soon, I imagine.
Thanks, JR. Loved it.